Hello, this is James Naughtie, and here is a programme from the Book Club Archive, first broadcast in 2004. Hello and welcome to Book Club from Birmingham, home, perhaps, who knows, to the Rummidge University that provides so much of the humour in David Lodge's novel Nice Work, which is our book of the month. It's a romp, a satire on Thatcherite Britain, and on some of the ways and assumptions in our universities, a book that does make you laugh out loud. We've got this month's group of readers here at the BBC's Pebble Mill Studios with David Lodge to talk about a story that hangs on the unlikely coming together in 1986's industry year shadow scheme of Vic Wilcox, factory managing director, about to enjoy his midlife crisis, and Robin Penrose, Dr. Robin Penrose, university lecturer in English, who's prey to many of the vanities and prejudices that Lodge often finds so comically associated with the universities which have provided him with so much inspiration for humour and social reflection in his fiction. He was, of course, a professor of English here at Birmingham University for many years, having, among other things, a celebrated friendship in the 60s with Malcolm Bradbury, whose novels, to their admirable joint amusement, always seemed to be getting muddled up together in some readers' minds. This plot is a comical meeting of two unlikely people who, of course, drift apart in the end when the strange magnetism evaporates, and they go back to lives which seem rather like the ones they would have continued to lead if they'd never met, although Robin does pass on part of an inheritance from Australia to Vic, so in that sense, at least, he is better off. And we're encouraged to think that their strange affair may well have opened up a new future for both of them, in some ways. David Lodge, welcome to Book Club. Rummidge University, let's be honest, it's here, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's a virtual university in a virtual world. The city of Rummidge is loosely based on Birmingham, and its university is a sort of medley of several universities, actually. But it's not identical with Birmingham. I could hardly have written the book had it been so. It's a familiar sort of strategy, I think, for novelists. So they want to give their work a kind of plausible, realistic and recognisable setting. But if you're specific about both the time and the place, then you run into the fact that this place was inhabited at that time by real people. So you have to have a kind of fictional version of the reality, and that's what Rummidge and Rummidge University is.
Particularly since those real people worked with you.
Sure.
It's a book written and conceived in the mid-80s, a time that's now quite distant. What were you trying to say? What were the things that were pricking your mind at that time about, I suppose, the height of Thatcherite Britain?
Yes, it was. I was very conscious of living in a city that was feeling the full brunt of Thatcherite economics in local industry, for instance, lost about a third of its companies over a period of a few years, and there was very high unemployment. At the same time, the university was being subjected, like all other universities in the country, to swingeing cuts, and there was a sense of hopelessness, I think, particularly among young people, about ever getting a job. Our students didn't really expect to get a job when they graduated. And young lecturers like Robin Penrose, who didn't have tenured jobs, were uncertain of their future. So I was really meditating on the paradox that people who were in work at that time were probably working harder than ever in their lives and probably doing quite well. But there was a large group of people who couldn't access that life, and so there was a kind of division between those who worked and those who didn't, those who had work and prospects, those who didn't. And I really started the novel with the idea of just the man. He was to be the central figure. He was to be a businessman who suddenly, he'd lived all his life for his job, and suddenly he was deprived of it. And what would he do? He might meet a woman from a completely different area, from the world of education or the arts, And it was only when I thought, well, I mean, I need to know what kind of work this man had done, that the novel really changed direction, because then I started to do the research to find out what kind of work he'd done. That seemed more interesting, really, than his life after work.
Well, one of the aspects of the novel I found so realistic and wonderful was the way you paint the picture of this city, if we're assuming it's this city, and that's the drive that Robin takes down the Aston Expressway and through Spaghetti Junction up towards where IKEA now is, mm-hmm. Where those factories are. And you said that you knew nothing or not a lot about metal bashing when you started to write it. Presumably you actually went to a factory and talked to people. What was that experience like? Were the people you spoke to in any way suspicious of your motives? Did they feel you were going to kind of play fast and loose with their characters?
I mean, the whole idea of the novel really came from when I started to do the research, and I shadowed a friend in industry, a managing director of an engineering foundry. Only one person recognised me that we met in the weeks that I followed him about. Everybody else took the story straight, because shadowing is quite a common institution in industry, and it was industry, yeah. I was, on the whole, rather impressed with the managers I met, actually. I thought that they were, you know, fairly dedicated people who were trying to keep their firms going in conditions of extreme competitiveness and great difficulty, that these were obviously not capitalists. I mean, they were salaried managers who could lose their own jobs if the company went bust, you know. So I suppose it was an education for me, and I made that point through Robin, really, who does have to kind of acknowledge that universities don't grow on trees. I mean, the wealth that funds them must come from somewhere.
I was really struck by how the academic world that you described almost, you know, 20 years ago in many ways still seemed quite fresh and relevant to some of the kind of political debate that's been going on about higher education and how to pay for it and who pays for it. I wonder if perhaps in your rereading for this kind of programme, if you were surprised at how resonant some of those ideas still are.
Well, certainly I think the debate which came to a head in the recent parliamentary vote on funding of higher education shows that, yes, the issues that Vic and Robin discuss, I mean, how do you fund universities, they're still relevant. At that time, the universities were being, you know, forcibly made to reform themselves. And I feel if they'd reformed themselves earlier on their own terms, they would have avoided a lot of the pain, actually, because I think they did need reform. But as it worked out, they were pushed into often inappropriate kinds of reform based on economic and market factors which really don't apply to education. And I tried to bring that out in the latter part of the book.
In some ways, it's a dark idea that you describe, but of course the point to make about the book is that it's terribly funny. And that's what our readers here, I can see by their reaction, feel about it. How do you, as readers, manage the comedy and the darkness behind?
I really liked it in the smallest details, I think. I have a very great fondness at the opening of the novel for the passage where he's talking about seeing the fox in the garden. Yeah. And you just have that line, it's like nature has gone on the dole, you know. Yeah. And it's a very funny line, but it absolutely sums up the feeling of those times, actually. It kind of came back to me, that feeling that somehow, as you say, people didn't expect to work, and even the foxes are going to just rummage around the dustbins and not bother to chase things properly.
I think now, because it's an historical novel, the comedy is kind of different in a way. I mean, I remember what David's referring to, the sense that people expected not to get a job. And, of course, reading it now, 20 years on, there isn't that same feeling. People feel perhaps they're going to get some kind of job, or they're going to make their own future in some way. And I'd kind of forgotten how that world had been. So the comedy is sort of different because it's not quite so immediate. You're not so worried about the personality and what's going to happen to them in terms of their real lives. But the contrast between the academic world and the industrial world is absolutely marvellous. And I found myself, first of all, laughing with them, but then pretty soon just laughing at them, both of them, all of them, all the way through the book.
Which do you find more ridiculous, the industrial world as it's portrayed or the academic world?
The industrial world became more less ridiculous, shall we say, as we went on. More proper, more appropriate, something to be admired.
And the academic world,
I mean, it started pretty low down anyway and became more and more ridiculous as the book proceeded on. And I was going to actually ask David whether he'd felt a loyalty with one of the characters more strongly at the start, and if that loyalty had changed as you'd gone through and started to write the book. Because I certainly felt that Vic was quite ridiculous at the start, but by the end he seemed a strangely heroic figure, having survived all of this and was being given a second chance. And Robin, I don't think, had changed so much, and she was still stuck in
the same world. It's a very interesting question.
Well, I think I started with a certain ironic, satirical distance on both of these characters. There's a certain amount of authorial kind of comment to this effect in the early chapters. And in a way, as I began to develop the story and began to set them interacting, they became more rounded. They became more human to me, in a way. And my own authorial voice sort of recedes, and I let them carry the ball, really, and take the novel on. And I think I tried to sort of be fairly even-handed in my sympathies, really. And this is the case of many of my novels, which often turn on some kind of opposition or contrast. And I find people read them in very different ways, usually according to their own predisposition or predilections.
Well, let's set these characters in context. Give us a reading from the novel, David, and set the scene.
This is on the day that Robin Penrose, the young lecturer, feminist theorist in English literature, comes to the factory for the first time and is given a tour by the managing director, Vic Wilcox, and she's appalled by the conditions in which she sees people working, the dirt and the filth and the noise. And this is a little bit of a conversation they have in the works canteen at lunchtime. And Vic really should have a Midland accent, but I'm not very good at that, but I'll do my best. "You don't want to get too sentimental about the operatives, you know," he went on. "They're a pretty crude lot. They seem to like dirt. We put new toilets in the fettling shop last November. In 2 weeks, they were all vandalised. Disgusting it was, what they did to those toilets." "Perhaps it was a form of revenge," said Robin. "Revenge?" Wilcox stared. "Revenge against who? Me, for giving them new toilets? Revenge against the system." "What system?" "The factory system. It must generate enormous resentment." "Well, nobody forces him to work here," said Wilcox, doubling the crust of his steak pie with a fork. "Well, that's what I mean. It's the return of the repressed. It's unconscious." "Oh, who says?" Wilcox inquired, cocking his eyebrow. "Freud, for one," said Robin. "Sigmund Freud, the inventor of psychoanalysis." "I know who you mean," said Wilcox. "I'm not completely solid between the ears, you know, even if I do work in a factory." "I wasn't implying that you were," said Robin. "Have you read Freud, then?" "Well, I don't get much time for reading," said Wilcox, "but I've a rough idea what he was about. Said everything came down to sex, didn't he?" "That's a rather oversimplified way of putting it," said Robin, disinterring some overcooked fish from its carapace of orange batter. "But basically right." "Well, not entirely wrong," said Robin. "The early Freud certainly thought libido was the prime mover of human behaviour. Later he came to think the death instinct was more important." "The death instinct? What's that?" Wilcox arrested the transfer of a morsel of meat to his mouth to put this question. "It's hard to explain. Essentially, it's the idea that unconsciously we all long for death, for non-being, because being is so painful." "Well, I often feel like that at 5 o'clock in the morning," said Wilcox, "but I snap out of it when I get up." But I think that illustrates the kind of initial kind of collision of minds with completely different mindsets and vocabularies and ways of thinking.
I think it's very interesting. You're talking about the opposites, and we basically have a book that is written half from a man's point of view, but basically half from a woman's point of view.
Yeah.
And that is still quite a dangerous thing to do. I think it was an even more dangerous thing to do in the 80s because mm-hmm. of the stage that feminism was at. And I think I recall sitting down to read it thinking, OK, let's see if you can do it then, and feeling completely in safe hands mm-hmm. once you had got Robin dressed. Mm-hmm. Because I think the way she chooses her clothes in the morning would do, you know, Trini and Susanna would be very proud of you, is all I can say.
That's a compliment, isn't it?
It's absolute compliment.
Right, just checking.
Absolutely, in a woman's mind. And I'd really like to ask you a little bit about that. I mean, it's the thing that all novelists have to attempt to do. Is that observation? Is that finding what's human in all of us? Because it is half the book. I mean, you were taking on something really big there.
I think that question, you should begin with a description of what she decides to wear.
Even more interesting than what she decides to wear that very first morning is what she decides to wear to go to the factory. She doesn't know.
Yes,
do you remember that scene?
She has to think about it.
Yeah, she has to think about that
very
carefully. She doesn't want to be too sexy or too overdressed. She doesn't want to put on her interview suit. Yes. On the other hand, you know, she doesn't want to dress drably either. So, I mean, that seemed to me to be the kind of occasion on which a woman would really be applying a lot of brain power to what she would wear. How does one do it? I mean, you're quite right that there was an element of risk about writing so much of the novel from a woman's point of view. I hadn't done that before. It was a slight advantage. I was using a third-person technique in my last novel, Thinks. I chose to write in the first person. That's much more difficult, I think, for a male novelist to do. I suppose to be a novelist, you've got to draw on the feminine side of your own personality, as a woman novelist must draw on the male side of her personality in order to kind of intuit how the other sex might react. You depend on, at least I depend heavily on journalism, on magazines. And so, you know, I read a lot of trivial stuff about fashion and so on, because that is valuable when you have to do this sort of work.
I think she's absolutely the epitome of an academic person. There is nothing that I don't know about her. And especially at that time, she's absolutely spot on. I have no hope for her.
Do you have hope for her, David?
Well, I did reintroduce her into my last novel, Thinks, actually. She'd become a rather bit of a slave-driving academic, head of a department of her own. But she was still a convinced literary theorist and post-structuralist. But she'd become a little bit more hard-nosed as a careerist, in a way, learned something, I think, from Vic Wilcox's management skills.
So there's still some hope.
Yes.
I felt that a person with potential for change was Mrs. Wilcox, but you didn't explore it. Do you have any feelings as to what might have happened to her?
Let's talk about Marjorie a little.
Well, Marjorie is a poor, defeated character, really, through most of the book. She is a simple-minded woman whom Vic met when they were both very young. She was in the typing pool, and she's just settled down to a life as a housewife, finding her outlet in shopping. And she is an image of the repressed woman by Robin's feminist standards.
Enjoy your menopause.
Yeah, well, that's another cross she's got to put up with. I mean, all women have to face that at some point. I mean, she's a minor character who's kind of foil to Robin. Robin thinks that Vic patronises her and doesn't do enough to try and liberate her. Vic himself feels really very little passion anymore for her, but a kind of moral responsibility for her, which is shaken when he has this infatuation with Robin. But again, at the end, when his own life is in real crisis and he loses his job, he turns to Marjorie, not to Robin, and recognises the real value of her loyalty.
You're listening to Book Club on Radio 4 with David Lodge discussing his novel Nice Work.
Talking about the appearance, the way Robin looked and looks, many people perhaps came to the book through the television adaptation or had their enjoyment of the book enhanced by it. And I don't know if you were involved with the television adaptation, whether you did it yourself. I wanted to ask you a more general question about what is lost from a book, apart from key scenes and length and subtlety and all kinds of things, when it is adapted.
It's a topic I could talk about for several hours, because I was involved. I did write the script, and I actually was involved in, you know, the production, and it was all done on location around here. A little bit to my embarrassment, actually, because they actually used Birmingham University as a location.
Oh, dear.
made the model a little bit too near to life. But it was a very happy experience, actually. I think Nice Work lent itself to adaptation in as much as it's a story which develops through the dramatic interaction of two characters. They're constantly debating and discussing and talking. What's difficult to adapt in fiction is psychological fiction, novels which happen mainly in the minds of the characters, because that's not something you can film. And if you turn it into voiceover, it's rather artificial. So it wasn't easy. It's never easy. And you do have to sacrifice some things. I think one of the favourite passages of readers in this book is Robin's analysis of the silk cut advertisement. And I couldn't get that in because, I mean, it would take about a fifth of an entire episode to represent it. So things like that, and it isn't actually essential to the story. So things like that have to go out.
It is one of my favourite passages in the book. It's very funny the way that Vic's bullish attitude towards Robin there, also at the same time where he is aroused by Robin.
Remind us what happens.
Well, Robin is discussing metonymy with Vic, trying to essentially explain to him as a layman what those terms mean. So what she does is she uses a cigarette billboard.
What else but a cigarette?
very much. And a silk cut.
That famous purple ad.
And Vic is very upset by this sexual reading of the advert. And I just think that that's one of the funniest parts in the book. But what it was leading me on to was to ask you, the book itself contains some quite detailed literary discussions. I'm interested into how you feel about putting that into essentially a mass market novel, a popular novel in many ways. Are you worried that the average reader, if there is such a thing, will skip those parts?
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Nice Work is a literary novel, and I never really anticipated when I wrote it that it would have the success it had, actually. So, I mean, most of my novels, perhaps all of them, have quite a lot of literary references, quite a lot of ideas in them. And, of course, Robin is a specialist on the Victorian industrial novel, though she's never been inside a factory, one of the comic ironies of the situation. But, of course, the Victorian novel did set out, and the industrial novel particularly, to try and make life better, to reconcile different classes and different interests. And so, with a slight tongue in the cheek, I was able to moralise a bit more in that novel than perhaps I would otherwise have done. Novels should, I think, give people information they didn't have when they started, but it has to be made accessible and amusing and entertaining in the way it's fed out, so that I always try to do that, so that there's some amusement to be got by, for instance, having Vic. He signs on to be a student at the university. He starts to shadow Robin, and he takes part in a tutorial. And you get it's fun for the writer, I think, to see how a tutorial might work with such an incongruous character sitting in among the students.
I wondered, as you know so much about literary and critical theory, and you've written a lot about that, whether it was a help or a hindrance when you come to write your own fiction.
To me, criticism was always something complementary to writing fiction. It didn't interfere with it. There were things about being a professor which occasionally seemed incompatible with being a novelist, but the actual act of critically analysing fiction, I found, gave me tools, gave me methods for solving technical problems in my own fiction. So I'm a very self-conscious writer. But while I was at Birmingham, I kept the two lives completely separate.
So were your colleagues generous about some of the characters?
I think they were. I was very careful.
Across your pages?
I was very careful not to portray anybody in any way that could be recognised or give offence. But I think they were pretty tolerant about the generally satirical view of their profession. Though I was implicated in the satire myself, of course. I mean, one reason why Nice Work is a slightly more serious book than its immediate predecessors, it was partly the result of, I think, a certain amount of unfavourable feedback from academics in particular to my previous novel, Small World, which was a carnivalesque satire on academic life, on conference going and the academic freebies and so on.
Pretty close to home.
Well, yes, but it was set in 1979. Just the year that Mrs. Thatcher came to power, in fact, when there was a sort of party atmosphere still in universities. And by the time it came out, 1984, the whole situation had changed. And I think some of my colleagues felt Small World was a rather inopportune book to be publishing at that time when the universities were fending off the cuts. So I think maybe that was what made me think, well, all right, I'll write a serious book about academic life this time, although it's funny. I'm glad you find it funny. I don't think of it as essentially a comic novel, really. It's a serious novel with comedy running right through it.
I wanted to ask David if captains of industry should be reading more fiction and more creative writing to be better employees or more rounded individuals. Did you get a sense of that's still important, or a message there?
Well, first of all, I think that people in commerce and industry actually read quite a lot. I mean, I found that the reason Nice Work was rather successful was that there was a huge audience of people whose lives are of this kind. They work in these kind of situations, environments, and no writer takes them seriously and writes about their lives. So they were very interested and they were very sympathetic. And it had very good reception in those areas. But I think as a general rule, yes, obviously, culture, if it has any social value, is something that everybody should have access to. And again, this is a theme of the Victorian precursors of nice work, that if you just run society according to strictly financial, economic or materialist criteria, you will create alienation and division.
When you quote Sybil or North and South or Hard Times or other novels of that genre from the Victorian era, do you share sometimes the optimism that often shone through, and even the sentimentality, especially in Dickens, that was such a part of that vision? Because your sentiment bubbles up quite strongly in this book.
I am rather inclined to that, and sometimes criticised for it. I mean, my endings are a little bit too reassuring or
to be accused of Dickensian endings is not an answer.
I've always, you know, as a student of literature, I was always fascinated by romance and Shakespearean romance and the, you know, the great late plays where everything, you know, good comes out of evil and all kinds of tensions and conflicts are suddenly resolved. I find that a very kind of inspiring literary dream, if you like. I like to try and find ways round our, you know, modern 21st century pessimism. I'm not naturally a tragic writer. I mean, I don't have a tragic view of experience. I have a comic view, and that can either be satirical or it can be comic in the sense of, you know, the Divine Comedy, I mean, of a happy ending, of a resolution. So there's always a... it's always difficult how to end a story, because that really sets a seal on the meaning of the story and it kind of implies what the writer actually thinks life is like. And the nice work, I sort of used the model of the 19th century novel to get round that problem.
What are the people's funniest moments, just as we end?
I just loved the moment when Philip Swallow had the phone call and kept going back and back, and you knew what was going to happen. And then, you know, and he banged his head against the waste bin. That was such a take on the typical university sort of head-in-the-clouds professor who's trying desperately to be of the world and yet is not of the world. And for me, the comedy came through more of the university characters than perhaps the in industry context.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like very much the bit about the foreplay, about Charles's foreplay, about how removed she was as an academic that she actually went to sleep and then woke up again and he was still at it. I love that. That made me laugh out loud.
Can't read that on Radio 4.
I can't think of a more appropriate place to draw proceedings to a close. David Lodge, thank you very much indeed for being this month's guest in Book Club. And to all our readers for joining us here in Pebble Mill. Remember, if you'd like to come to a Book Club recording, you can let us know on our website, bbc.co.uk/bookclub, or you can write to us at Broadcasting House, London W1A 1AA. Next month, on the first Sunday of June, you can hear Minette Walters discussing her rather dark thriller, why did I say rather, The Scold's Bridal. Next week, at this time, on Radio 4, it will be, of course, Mariella Frostrup with Open Book. Until next month, and the next book, from all of us here at Pebble Mill, goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.